The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Discover the power within. UnityOnlineRadio.org. The voice of an awakening world.
Discover hope and healing from the other side. Welcome to Messages of Hope with Suzanne Giesman.
Listen, they're all around you, close as a thought or a memory. Messages of Hope.
Well, welcome back, everybody, for another episode of Messages of Hope. I just love listening to that theme song. It gets me motivated every time. And my guest today is the perfect guest for giving all of us hope. William Peters, you may not have heard of him, but you will, because I want you to run out and get his new book. We're going to talk all about that today, but I want him to introduce himself. I always love that so much more than reading a biography to you. So, William, welcome to the show.
Suzanne, thanks for having me. Real pleasure to be here.
You and I were saying we met at an IANS conference, International Association of Near-Death Studies. So we're going to dive into that later as well. But how about just giving that the brief background?
So I'm a psychotherapist by training. I specialize in grief and bereavement. And I help pretty much anything end of life is what I've been drawn to. And I was a hospice worker for many years. I worked at the Zen Hospice Project. Which is a very, you know, Buddhist-oriented way of dealing with death and dying, which I gravitated to because it's much more accepting of death as a natural part of life. So those are kind of the key kind of training aspects of this. But what I really, how I got into the research was really my own experiences. I had two near-death experiences, and I could go into them in a bit more detail, but really just to say that I had a high-speed skiing accident, was catapulted.
Oh, wait. Well, we're not going to slough over the near-death experiences.
Okay.
we all love hearing those.
Okay.
So just give me a second, because the one thing I didn't say is that the whole focus today, as I mentioned your book, is on shared death experiences.
Yeah.
And let me just, for those of you who will be watching this later on video, I'm holding up a copy of the book. It's At Heaven's Door, What Shared Journeys to the Afterlife Teach About Dying Well and Living Better. I love that title. So before we hear about your near-death experiences, how about telling everybody what a shared death experience is?
Yeah, so a shared death experience occurs when somebody's dying, and a caregiver, loved one, and sometimes even just a bystander will report that they shared in this journey with the dying from this human existence into a benevolent afterlife. And there's many, many features along that geography. But for your listeners, the most important thing as a kind of an alignment way, a way of orienting, I should say, is that the shared death experience is almost identical to a near-death experience in terms of phenomena. There are some differences, but generally they track very similarly. And this should not surprise us, because this is the same terrain between this life and what lies beyond. In a near-death experience, which I've had two of, it is a brush with death. You go over the threshold, you see the initial stages of the afterlife, and a lot of phenomena, features, which, like I said, we can go into. The shared death experience is just a person healthy in mind and body, and they are typically have a good bond, a close bond with the person dying. And for some reason we don't really know yet, they are invited in to share in this journey and observe the same phenomena that they're experiencing. So these are veil-crossing, phenomena-rich experiences.
And I love that you don't have to die to have that experience. I've had quite a few people who have had those near-death experiences, which are actually actual death experiences. They just come back from it. In fact, last week's guest, Tony Sicoria, had that experience as well. But I'm intrigued by, we'll get to this later, just being a bystander. I just want to hear some examples of that. I didn't get to read the whole book. I read so many experiences that are shared in here, which are just phenomenal. But we'll talk about that later. But let's talk about yours. How about the first near-death experience?
Yeah. So 17 years old, typical high school age young man, went up skiing to Lake Tahoe, California, going down the mountain, caught an edge, flew into the air, knew this was not a good thing. I was in the air for too long. And when I landed, I crushed my spine. Ow. And I was catapulted out of my body. And it was dark for a little bit, which is kind of an interesting feature. Like, I didn't feel or sense anything, although I had an observing presence that was just looking at darkness. And then all of a sudden the light started coming on. And the first thing I really noticed was that I could see my body on the slopes, and I was moving very quickly away from my body. And I could see Lake Tahoe and then San Francisco Bay Area and Colorado Rockies. Yeah, it was at getting, and eventually I had a satellite view of everything, and it was all very peaceful.
You know, I found that very interesting reading that account in your book, how you had this full earthly experience. You were pulling away from the earth instead of just dissolving into the light. You were literally pulling back from the stage.
Yeah, very well. Yeah, great point, because I was just, being drawn out of this whole human existence, the whole earth plane. And soon I was in a beautiful galaxy, enamored, enthralled, no pain, but very much observing. And while my life was getting reviewed at this time, I didn't really notice it was getting reviewed until I go, oh, wait a minute, I'm seeing a movie of my life here.
Oh boy.
And then I was in this tunnel that was kind of ribbed and opaque. I could see a beautiful galaxy out beyond the tunnel, but the real moment of kind of awakening was when I saw the light and I realized, oh, I'm dying. And not only that, I've been here hundreds of times before. Like, I knew exactly where I was, and I was upset because,
Well, what I was going to say is I love that this was long before NDEs became so popular that most of us are familiar now with that tunnel. Yeah. And you had that experience.
Yeah, this is 1979. And even though Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, which really introduced the near-death experience to the world in a certain way, that was 1975. But in my culture, I had no exposure to this.
Yeah.
So when I did see the light, and I immediately started pleading with the light. I grew up Catholic. So I when I saw the light, I just said, God, I'm not ready to die. I mean, I was just so honest. God, I am not ready to die. And I started having a conversation. It was really me talking, and I wasn't getting a whole lot from God. They was just there. And I went into the light, and it was, divine. It was the best feelings I've ever felt. And yet, unlike most near-death experiencers, I still did not want to stay. I wanted to go back.
Yeah, that is unusual.
Very, very, very unusual. And I had this sense, I have to go do something. I did not achieve what I went into this life to do. Not that I knew what that was, but I was pleading to go back. I also had this sense of, it was kind of interesting, I didn't want to go through my childhood again. Like, I was like, I want to go back. I've made it this far. Let me go. And I came back, spun back into my body. I remember I was coming back. I was like, how am I going to get back in my body? Like, how am I going to find planet Earth? I was just like, but I was zinging back like gravitationally. Then I realized, oh, there's some sort of guidance here. I'm just going to let go. And then eventually I was back in my body, and it was a boom back in my body. And I felt the cold of the snow on my back. I felt the pain in my back. And I didn't have any sensation in my extremities. And I remember screaming inside my head, God, don't let me be paralyzed.
Oh yeah.
And I felt the sensation come back into my extremities, like being under a warm shower. You feel that energy move across your body. So it came back, and I had, if I were to do that again, which I hope I'm not, I would have said, and don't let me live with severe chronic debilitating pain, because for the next 4 decades, I really struggled with back pain and walking and some severe limitations. So,
wow. And how did you overcome that, just briefly? Because it gets us off track, but.
Well, I mean, I really became a spiritual practitioner. I mean, I went really dove into Eastern meditation practices, primarily because it allowed me to sense deeply into my body and sensations. And I think also leave my body, kind of of that. So I got a sense of a self that was bigger than, more expansive than the pain in my body.
Perfect.
So it was kind of interesting. I was working both ends of that continuum, feeling more into the pain, but going through it and realizing I'm more than that pain. And then the gift of all this physical pain has been that I've developed these wonderful practices that I think later really helped me have these shared death experiences. Because when I'm with the dying, it's really about attuning. It's really about being with them and allowing yourself to go with them where they're going. That's a whole nother topic we can get into, but
because you're not just writing about them. It sounds like you're preparing yourself to do it and have done it with others.
Exactly.
I know you did with you had an amazing experience with your dad at the end of his life, if not a shared death experience. And I definitely want to talk about that. It really touched me reading that in your book. But how about the second NDE? Is this an appropriate time to talk about it, or does that come later in your story?
Well, let's do something. There's one other chapter piece that's very important for the evolution of the understanding of the SDE, and that is, I went to South and Central America really because I had been so transformed by my NDE that the world I lived in didn't make sense to me anymore. All of my programming about going out and getting a profession and, you know, making money and getting a big house, a lovely family, no criticism of that. It was just something that, for me, the level of pain I was dealing with just didn't add up. And so I decided I wanted to be with people who were underprivileged and suffering. And I didn't know it at the time, but as I look back retrospectively, I realized they had something to teach me. And I wanted to go, and I just followed that intuition. So I found myself working actually with the Jesuit International Volunteers, a liberal arm of the Catholic Church, working with refugees and teaching in their schools. And it was started in Belize and then went to Guatemala and then went to Peru. The latter two had civil wars going on. So this was really tough work, but very meaningful. And I was able to work with indigenous people, primarily refugees from the wars in Peru, and learned a bit about shamanism, that worldview, which I was just so open to, because when I'd hear the stories, I think unconsciously, I never linked them directly to my near-death experience that I can remember, but I think I was like, oh, traveling through the universe. Oh, seeing different dimensions. Oh, the light. Oh, I think it all just kind of fit, even though the lights didn't go on like, this is my near-death experience. Not that I can remember, but the point being is it was comforting to me. And I learned so much from being in these cultures with these people. I came back and I got a position as a social worker in San Francisco, and the AIDS epidemic broke out. And I was a frontline direct service social worker in what we call the Tenderloin of San Francisco, the Skid Row part. And thousands of gay men were primarily impoverished, wiped out by their experience of the virus, and had to move to the poor part of San Francisco. And I ended up working with a lot of these people and communities. And I heard stories from the men who would, you know, one in particular I shared in the book, but I'll do it briefly now. And that is, I was very close to this gentleman, Brad, close in the way that it was a client relationship, that he would come in and he would get food for his community, would get counseling for what he was dealing with. And he was kind of what we'd call a psychopomp. He was helping people cross over at the end of life. That's a Greek term for, you know, psychopomp means somebody who helps people die and takes them from this life into the next.
Or a doula, right?
Yeah, a doula. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yes, yeah, so a modern day doula. And so he came to me one morning and said, I said, he walked in the door. He didn't say anything. I looked at him. I said, Brad, you look, what happened? You just look, you know, beleaguered. And he goes, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't get a chance to groom myself, but Randy died last night. I go, Randy died. Oh, I'm so sorry. He says, yeah. He says, it's sad, but it was so beautiful. And I said, beautiful, tell me. Well, he tells this story of his community gathered around Brad's community gathered around Randy's bed. And at the moment of death, they saw a cylinder of light coming down. And he says, Brad said, Randy traveled up this light. And when he got just to the top of the light where we could, you know, still see him, he looked down at us and he thanked all of us. And he thank you for caring for me. And what we noticed was that he was younger, he was healed, he was vibrant, he was healthy, and he was happy. And then he went up further into the light and disappeared. Well, when I heard that, I mean, he was looking at me like, do you believe me, William? Yeah. And I said, yes, that makes sense to me. And I just said it like that. He goes, and he looked at me, he goes, makes sense to you. He goes, well, and that's when I made a connection. I had something similar to this at one point in my life. And so for me, I was very inherently open based on my experience.
No accidents there.
No accidents. Yeah. No accidents. Yeah. And so I would work with Brad and others. I became somewhat known as someone who was very open to these spiritual experiences that were happening all over this part of town, because so many people were dying, wow, really gruesome deaths of the early days of AIDS. So I share that because there's my real first introduction to these shared death experiences. No name, no nothing really, other than I believe you make sense. And I started hearing more about them.
I have to interrupt you a second as I look at your book cover, At Heaven's Door, and there's this very narrow, but this light that goes right down the middle. At first, I thought this is a publisher's mark that says this is a sample book, you know, because it came straight from the publisher for the radio show. And then I said, no, it's not. That's the light that connects us to the heavens.
That's right.
Very clever cover.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Second NDE. I was 30 years old. So a few years after I was working in San Francisco, I contracted a rare blood disease, idiopathic thrombocytopenia. And that means it's a hemophiliac condition. I was drowning in my blood. I went into the ER. They put an alert on me and I woke up about, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours later. And I was hovering above the ICU at Kaiser Oakland Hospital. At this point, from what I can remember, I don't have any sense of an identity of being William or anything. I was just in this ICU, listening to the nurses, listening to the custodial staff, kind of just curious, content, happy, but definitely an observing consciousness. I mean, but no identity, no William there. Until the nurses, I listened to the nurses go through the various patients in the ICU, and they described this guy who was 30 years old, young and healthy, no real history for being in this part of the hospital. And they were perplexed by him. And so I go, that's interesting. I'll take a look at him. So I move my little consciousness across the ceiling. Then I look down and I saw my face in the bed. I said, wow, oh my gosh, that's me. And I made the connection. And there's a little more to the story. If you're interested, it's in the book. But the basic idea was, I realized, oh my gosh, I am not my physical body.
Well, yeah, but the nurses at this point must have been totally freaking out, because clearly you're not in the body anymore. You're the soul.
Well, I don't know what they saw. But
maybe
I thought
you were still sleeping or something.
Yeah, they thought I was totally sleeping. I did not. I was out from what I could tell. I mean, I didn't, honestly, Suzanne, I didn't even spend much time looking at that body. I mean, I looked at the body, something that's interesting. And then I said, well, that's me down there. And then I went into my own consciousness and moved. I said, this is interesting. I'm up here. And I moved down the hallway and I started exploring.
But the point you made when I rudely interrupted you there was huge, that you had this realization, I am not my body.
That's right.
Yeah.
That right. And then at this point, some time later, it always takes a while to process and integrate these, because I'm still not talking about these experiences with anybody. I don't remember sharing them with people.
And you just found yourself back in your body all of a sudden. That was it.
Okay. This is a great question. So the doctor walks in. I still remember his name, but I won't say it, from UCSF. And he announces, he goes, I am so-and-so. I'm a specialist in idiopathic thrombocytopenia, which you have. It's a very rare blood disease. And then he said, Mr. Peters. He kind of said that first. Then he introduced himself, Mr. Peters. And he was tapping on me. And I'm looking up at above and I'm going, do I want to go into that body? Like, if I answer him, what will all these questions about, well, I'm up here. Can I answer him from up here? What will happen if I, can I even answer him? If I talk, will he hear me? All these questions were going through my mind. And eventually I just said, well, I'll answer him. And as he's tapping on me, Mr. Peters. And then as I say, yes, it was kind of a slow yes. As I went back into that dimension, it was kind of like, yes. And as I did that, I could feel the energy come back over my body, like that shower experience, the warm water coming through and filling out me energetically. And then as I opened my eyes, I realized, oh my gosh, I'm looking at this world again through my physical body, which was so different than just moments before, because I was seeing this doctor and my body from above. Yeah. And now I'm looking up at them and it's just a different view.
Have you been able to pop out on your own?
Well, I think you know the response. My answer to that. So there is definitely now that I've had these experiences, unless I was always, you know, capable of this, which I don't think, I can go and be with people who are dying, and.
Otherwise known as an out-of-body experience, to go visit them. Yeah,
exactly. So let me go to this next experience, because I think this will really answer your question with a great example. So I joined Zen Hospice Project, as I mentioned, and I really joined it because I was fascinated by death and dying at this point. And I had the opportunity to spend many hours a day as a volunteer just sitting at the bedsides of people who were dying. On this one afternoon, I was reading to Ron. Now, Ron had been unresponsive. That means he was not communicative at all, kind of in a comatose state. Yeah. He'd been that way for a number of days, but I knew him beforehand, and I had been reading him a story out of a book. I still remember the book. It was Jack London's Call of the Wild. And he loved it. It was an adventure story. So I'm reading to him one afternoon, like any other afternoon, and all of a sudden I pop out of my body. Uh-huh. And I am suspended above my body and Ron's body that's prone. I am looking at my body down below. I'm seeing the crown of my head. I'm seeing the words on the page. I can't decipher them. I can even see my voice speaking. I don't know if I can actually hear what I'm saying. I'm not focused on that. But Ron is right to my right in spirit. But now he's not.
Yeah.
But
wow.
I say he's in spirit only because he's not in his body. He looked fully like a human face. I didn't see anything more than his beautiful face, eyes wide open, smiling, radiant smile, teeth white, as if to say to me, check this out.
Oh.
Check this out.
And reminds me of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. Suddenly this face is just right there.
Exactly.
Wow.
And so that was, as you said already, that's an out-of-body experience. And in the shared death experience language that we use, that's a co-experienced OBE, co-experienced out-of-body experience. So we're doing it together. He's out of his body. I'm out of my body. And this points to the response to your question. Do I easily go out of my body? And the truth of the matter is, I do. And if I'm with people who are dying, I will very easily go to different realms, different dimensions. I think I have a very loose or a looser connection to my physical body.
And to what do you attribute that? Because I hear people right now listening and they're saying, I want to do that. And they have big books on it. And I've practiced and I still don't get to that point.
Well, I think it's because I was catapulted out of my body initially. And I think, you know, I just have, shall we say, porousness in that relationship of embodiment. I think I was forced out of it. And I think, you know, and that it's never really sealed up in a way that would make it, it's just permeable for me.
Yeah, that feels right.
And I like that permeability, but also it has some downfalls with it. You know, in other words, I can feel things and be pulled out of myself in ways that I wish I could stay at home sometimes more. Like, you know, I things are going on around me. If I'm in a trauma situation and I can feel the pull, I can feel my body, you know, my soul, spirit, whatever, kind of wanting to go out or just being drawn out.
Kind of like people who have epilepsy who know that a seizure is coming on. You can tell when you're about to separate your consciousness.
Yeah. I actually feel a gravitational pull on my soul. I feel like there's an energetic soul chest, you know, I feel like there's something really big going on here. I'm trying to get up higher so you can see. But
And we're just about out of time. We have to go to a break. But yet your body is still functioning. So there is still a connection. You can't completely leave the body if you're.
Even when I leave my body, I still, when I come back, everything's kind of still here. I don't know what happens when I leave. It's not these pure out of body experiences. That's one thing. It's like OBEs, they're not all alike. I mean, you go to different dimensions. And so I think
we have to go to a break, unfortunately, William. Okay. So everybody, when we come back, we're really going to focus more on the shared death experience. That's our little alarm going off, so I didn't miss the break. But we'll be right back after the break for more with William Peters, author of At Heaven's Door.
Practical spirituality, positive messages. This is UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Messages of Hope with Suzanne Giesemann.
All right, welcome back. That break was just right to allow us to shift more in our focus here in our conversation. We've been talking about William Peters' near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, so NDEs and OOBs. But now let's talk about SDEs, the shared death experience. Your book is full of what I call NOEs, no other explanation stories.
Yeah.
So you've had these your own experiences. Tell us how you became an expert in this field.
Yeah. So when I was at hospice volunteering, I would have many of these experiences. I shared one already that I had with Ron. But what's important to note is that the Zen Hospice Project, who I loved the organization, and my supervisor, Eric, was just a veteran, open-hearted man. But when I would share, when I shared one of these experiences with him, this one with Ron, I remember being excited saying, hey, I was just felt like I was out of my body with Ron over there. And Eric's a great guy. And he says, you know, oh, halfway between heaven and hell. You know, all sorts of things can happen here, William. It's just phenomena, you know, let it go. You know, Mary needs you over there on bed 3.
And, oh boy.
And I was like, oh, well, okay. And that's very Buddhist, by the way. You know, you let go of your experiences. You don't hold on to anything, non-attachment. Don't get ego attached anyway. So, but I was disappointed that I didn't have a chance to dialogue. And more than that, that nobody really that knew about it. Like if Eric didn't know about this experience, I knew that the entire hospice field was not engaging with this because he was just 3 decades of doing this work and very spiritual man. So no fault of Eric. The fact of the matter is the field had not identified this experience. And so I had more of these experiences while I was working at bedside. I wouldn't share them with anybody. And then by this time, I knew it was more related to, I was closely aligned to my NDE, but I could see very little literature about it. I mean, I heard some experiences when I did my lit reviews and literature reviews, but nobody really put a name on this. They called it apparitions, at-death apparitions, that type of thing. Oh, visitations. I mean, there's all sorts of things, but no one really got this experience until I went to go listen to Raymond Moody in 2009. And Raymond was, I thought Raymond was going to talk about the near-death experience, but he says, hey, I'm going to talk about another experience that's very closely related to the near-death experience. It's the share-death experience. And then he describes the share-death experience as I've already defined. And when I heard him talk about it, my whole body lit up and said,
oh my gosh. Goosebumps again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Goosebumps. And I went up to him and I said, not only have I had a lot of these as a hospice workers, I think I know how to help people have these. And he looked at me and he said, wow, we don't even know how they happen. I said, well, is anyone doing research on it? He goes, no. And I said, right then, I said, well, I will. And that's when I began formulating my ideas for starting the Shared Crossing Project with the intention of raising awareness and educating people about these profound and healing end-of-life experiences that include primarily the shared death experience, but others, and we study others as well. But this is the primary one that I got focused on. And it was with the goal of transforming people's relationship to end-of-life and allowing them to have these experiences, quite frankly, so that they knew who they truly were. That's what I was really, the freedom, as you well know, Suzanne, comes in knowing who we truly are.
Goosebumps again. That's that word freedom. That is what this is all about. Yeah. Freedom from the suffering. Your book right here, which teaches us about dying well. We don't talk about death. And I love that it grabs your attention and you say, dying well. You mean I don't have to be afraid?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and so just because you said that term, being afraid, the probably most common after effect of a shared death experience for the experiencer is any fear or anxiety I had about death is gone. Now I'm curious. Now I'm excited. Now I'm receptive. And now a lot of people say, I just find it's the most wondrous event. I don't want to die, but I certainly want to get to know about it, prepare for it, and talk about this with my loved ones. So the shared death experience is highly transformative for experiencers. And the other piece that's so important about this, Suzanne, is they come back. The experiencers come back from these profound experiences, often at the deathbed. But as I'll say, 2/3 of these experiences happen remotely. So you don't even have to be at a bedside, which is stunning. And a big surprise in the literature from when I started presenting this research, people were like, what? I said, no, this is also another point for, you know, non-local consciousness and how we're connected across time and space. And, you know, so once again, that's a whole nother beautiful rabbit hole we can go down. But the point is that the experiencers will say that I know that my loved one is alive and well in a benevolent afterlife, and I know that I'll see them again. Those statements right there. When you talk about how that impacts grief, I'm a psychotherapist specializing in grief and bereavement. One of my main reasons for writing this book, getting it out to the world, is so people can realize if you can embrace these as a possibility even, then you will have a much different grief and bereavement process. They'll be so much more meaningful. You know, you're always going to have pain around the loss of someone you love. But as you said already, Suzanne, our culture is so out of relationship with death that once you go through it, not only are you pushed to the margins of society, you become a pariah, like, oh, I can't talk to, you know, Suzanne, someone just died in her family. You know, it's like, what? No, we need to bring that person into the middle of our family, into the middle of our community, give them center stage and say, what do you need? And can you tell us how this was for you? You know, if they're willing to talk, because if they've had an experience, the first thing they're going to say is, well, this is what I experienced. And if we can receive them and just make space, And like you said, you know, there's already, you know, Helping Parents Heal is a great organization, as we know, that's doing just this in grief and bereavement. So I'm not, I don't want to say that it's not being done. I just say that, you know, Elizabeth Boysson and others who are bringing this wisdom into the world, we need more of it.
Right.
Because it's so healing and so transformative.
It is transformative. I remember recording my radio show because I had to, it was live, from another room in the hospice where my mother was transitioning. She was going through the process just down the hall, and it was a sad time, but it's that knowing that we have that she's going to go through this beautiful journey. I can't stop her at 92 years old. The body's done, but it just transforms that from when I was in that same hospice with my dad 10 years earlier and just coming to know what we know. I love how you said that most of those who, if not all of those who share their SDEs are of sound mind and body. So right away, people can't say, well, they're just crazy. They're just, you know.
Yes. Yes. This was a big step forward in the kind of the healthcare providers and consciousness community, because the near-death experience, as you know, has often been maligned as being a fear-death experience, a change in trauma causing biochemical reactions in the brain. Yet the SDE happens in the minds and bodies of healthy people unknowingly encountering these experiences. And it's the same as the NDE. So you can't discount it. So
how about then, since everybody who follows my work knows that I'm evidence-based medium, I need those verifiable things. How about sharing with us a story or two of people of sound mind and body who had an SDE with something evidential in it?
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, so I'll give you one here. So this is, all right. So Sonia is in Massachusetts, and her good friend Denny is dying in Santa Barbara, California. She doesn't know she's dying, but she, and the reason why is Denny actually used the medical aid in dying because she had a very, very severe cancer that was painful for her. So, but Sonia didn't know this. So Sonia describes getting super tired early in on Friday evening, falling asleep, and waking up and finding herself with Denny at a river, side of a river, and they're beginning a journey. So the one thing that I would really want your listeners to know is the dominant motif in the shared death experience is journey. You're always progressing, and you're progressing towards the light. Whether you see the light or not, eventually you will. And that's the movement. So what Sonia describes is this journey with Denny up, you know, across rivers, up ladders, all over different terrains, other people with them. And all of a sudden they arrive at this party, this welcoming party. But they're early, and they go in, and there's dancers that are supposed to be there. Denny was a dancer in her life. But Sonia didn't know this, but there's this big dancer party coming, and food's going to be served.
Well, see, there's a little bit of evidence right there, the dancing thing.
A little bit of evidence right there that Sonia didn't. Well, I knew Denny liked dancing, but I didn't know she was a ballerina of you know, when she was younger. Now, Denny, of course, is in her 70s here, late 70s. So Sonia's not familiar with her whole previous life. So what then happens is Sonia realizes that as they're serving the food and the people are welcoming her, Sonia realizes, oh my gosh, this is a party for Denny, and I'm here, but I'm really not supposed to be here. Oh. And she wakes up in her bed, and it's in the middle of the night, and she's sweating and she's crying, and her husband says to her, "What's going on?" She goes, "Denny just died." But she goes, "What do you mean? Denny's in Santa Barbara. She's, you know, we know she has cancer, but there's you don't receive anything about her death." She goes, "No, I know she just died. I was just with her." And her husband says, "Well, come on now." The next day, Sonia gets up and she gets on Facebook and realizes that Denny had died the day before. What's interesting, another evidential piece, which may seem minor, but not to me as a researcher, is that Sonia describes vividly what Denny had on as a dress in that journey with her. And Denny was always very meticulous about the way she dressed. She cared very much about her. She was a very regal woman. And so dress was important to her. She had on this dress, Sonia says, that was very unique. She hadn't really ever seen this in a certain way. It was a distinct color with a print. A month later, she gets a catalog in the mail and she opens it up and she goes, "That's Denny's dress. I've never seen it before anywhere." And so for Sonia, she says, "This is for me. Like, this is absolute." And she looks at the catalog. She don't even get this catalog. So it's like, oh my gosh. So for her, I'm like, you know, I study synchronicities a lot and see, and after a while,
it's the web.
So yeah. This is part of the web. Does that stand in and of itself as evidence? No. But when you put a number of these features together, this piece about Denny arriving early to the party, like they weren't really ready for her. That also speaks to the fact that she did choose to end her life with medical aid and medical assistance early.
Wow.
So that's a powerful piece too. Like, and Sonia picked it up. Sonia's like, wait a minute. Maybe I was allowed to be here because we got here early and I just kind of went in with Denny and they weren't even like, I got through the door before they even knew I was here with her. And there's all these very interesting things in the spirit realm, which I know, Suzanne, this is really your area of expertise. So I'm going to be careful, but say from my vantage point, I see these very interesting data points in testimony from people that suggest there is a plan. There is this force that's conducting our transition from the human body into the spirit realm. It is far more organized than we give credence to. And quite frankly, it's awe-inspiring and beautiful about all these people on the other side. Call them people. They look like people. They're spirit beings.
Yeah. Well, talking for a minute. I would agree with everything you've said there, William. How about strictly from personal experience, how about this one figure or being that is common, not the same one, but a role that you've given a name to?
Thank you. The conductor.
Yeah.
So if there's anything, I feel myself I get such a huge smile when I get a chance to talk about the conductor, because I noticed in reviewing accounts and listening to so many people over the years, I remember in my clinical practice, somebody coming in and first sharing, well, I was with my mother and he wasn't at bedside, actually. He was remote. He goes, but what was so interesting is there was this presence that I could kind of see, but kind of not, that was coaxing my mother's spirit out of her body, like trying to coordinating this transition. And this being was so focused and I was watching this, like I was a witness to this, and I'm not even sure anyone knew I was there, but here I am. I break into the scene. I knew my mother was on hospice. I didn't know she was dying, but here I am. I'm here and I'm watching this. And then all of a sudden I see my mother's spirit, kind of pulled out of her body peacefully. And then this being is gathering, holding my mother. And then they start going upwards, supported by the conductor, and they disappeared. They went into this light in the distance. Well, when I heard this at first, I didn't know how to make sense of it. I said, that's really interesting. But then I started seeing this force over and over again in different ways. Sometimes it's a spirit being. It's like a big ominous angel that has wings. Even one case with this woman, Angela, talks about being at the
death. But not ominous in a scary way, right? Just powerful.
Good point. Sometimes at first, the force, the conductor can look ominous. But then and one of the reasons it can be ominous is because it has such a mission to do its work. It's very focused. It's very clear. The work, I dare say, even looks a bit serious sometimes. Like they're really working with the schedule. It's like there's a lot of things they're trying to put together. But as you watch the process, generally, Almost all the time, it becomes one of love and care and compassion. So it's not to be feared. I think we just need to have awareness that if you ever find yourself in this space and you see this being who's conducting things and they're serious and they're focused, then you just know you're working with what I call the conductor. This is the facilitator, the one in charge of making this transition happen. Now, I will say, to be really clear, most of the cases you see beautiful beings of light. There's a few cases. In fact, if your viewers are interested, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I want to hear about what you wrote about your father's passing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was amazing. You would have think you're a medium in your own right because you really had a mediumistic experience.
I did. But I just want to say, just to encourage your listeners, if they go to sharecrossing.com and go to our story library, go to Amelia and John. Those are two cases. They both have the conductor in them in different forms. Amelia's has this beautiful lady. She goes, that lady is so beautiful, so beautiful. And what this beautiful woman does, the spirit being of light does, is really assumes, takes Amelia's 13-year-old son who's dying of cancer and takes him into the afterlife. It's beautiful. So, all right, my father. So here I am with my father, and I'm thinking my mother is in my father's hospital bed, holding him, supporting him. And my sister's there at this time as well. And as I'm, what I do when I'm with the dying is I breathe with them. I pray with them. I give myself over to whatever they need and just ask to be of assistance. And that's, and just open myself. And as I was doing that, I closed my eyes. And all of a sudden, I found myself in this other dimension. And in this dimension was very close. Like I could still feel myself in my body, but I could see at the foot of my bed, at the foot of my father's bed, it wasn't my bed, father's bed. I saw my grandmother. I saw my aunt, and they were right next to each other. And they were dressed in old Irish attire, which would have been significant for my grandmother because she was, she was, I think, first generation Irish. And then I saw this other man that I recognized as my grandfather, but I never knew him because he died before I was born and he had a nice suit on. And so I saw all these beings there. Also felt other beings there, other family members, other, my father's family friends from he was very close to the kids he grew up with elementary school. But then I see this beam of light coming down from them. And it's coming down at an angle that would connect them at the foot of his bed right to his kind of heart space, crown space with that angle. So I get right away, I'm like, that light is going to be the stairway that my father goes up. I know that. I can know that. And I said, why aren't you taking him? He's ready. He's laboring with his breath. And I'm actually a little bit like, hey, why aren't you taking him? They avert their vision and point me kind of just up and over the center of my father. And the minute my energetic attention goes there, I feel in and right in my heart just goes boom. It comes alive and I'm like, and gets activated. And I go, that's the force. That's the conductor. I could feel that presence managing that space and managing the transition. I started weeping right then.
We want to take your dad, but this guy's in charge.
Yeah. Well, what they really said to me is we're the welcoming party. We're here for your father. We're here for my son, for my brother, when he gets here, but he's in charge. Yeah. And it was a he. It felt like a he in this case. They're different genders and what have you. But when I felt that, my heart resonated. I mean, I started weeping right there. Oh my gosh, the power of this spirit being was spectacular. I don't have the words for it, Suzanne. It's beyond anything that I felt in this realm. It's just like all the energy that's moving, all that he was managing to make this transition happen. And then a few moments later, he was gone. Unfortunately, I was interrupted and I had to answer something in the human realm. And so
I feel that it's important to share what you shared in the book, that your mom had a role in that.
Oh yeah. Oh, thank you. Okay, great. You're right. So my mother, I announce that the family's here. Everyone's here. And I actually even said, my grandfather came forward at this time and said to my, tried to get close to my mother, and he was moving towards her. And then he said to her, which I translated, thank you for being such a, still moving right now, such a wonderful wife to my son. And she had never met him. So for him, he had lived his life in the spirit realm, never having met my mother, who my mother and father had a beautiful 64-year relationship. So he was genuinely wanting to express that. But then he got kind of a little bit told to go back to his place by the conductor. The conductor said, not now. Like, hey, get back in your place. I mean, it was benevolent. But like I said, the conductor has this paradoxical role of being loving and kind and in charge and businesslike. It's a job that the conductor is doing. So, but I say to my mother, hey, I don't know what's going on here. The light is coming down. It seems like it's all ready to happen. You know, I don't know why he's not going. And my mother exclaims naturally, totally unfiltered response, he's not going because I'm holding him here. And then she exclaims, I mean, she says to, you know, in this really honest, humble voice, he can go now. Bob, you can go. Go to your family. And she, you know, she says, thank you for loving me. So it's really powerful.
Yeah. And then he did.
And then moments later, he was gone. It was that's just how it happened. And, you know, a really beautiful scene, but as you can tell, packed full of emotion. And from one of the reasons I love being with death and dying, I know that sounds a bit strange, but it's true, is that the soul, the language of the soul is emotion.
Oh yeah.
And the gift to be at these tender moments is to feel all of this. So yeah, it's a gift to be with people when they're dying, and especially when they're family members, you know, or people you're close to.
Well, we only have a minute and a half to go. I feel an important point, and people listening are probably by now thinking, I want to have that experience with my loved ones. And I believe one of the main points you make in your book is that we can't ensure it, we can't guarantee it, but those most often who do have them are those, like everybody tuning in right now, who are already open to it.
Yes.
What do people need to know with 1 minute to go, William?
Yeah, I mean, you said it, Suzanne. Receptivity, acceptance that death is a natural part of anyone's process. So when you're with loved ones, or you know, or when it's your time to go, have these important conversations to say thank you for the life we spent together. I'm so grateful for our time in this lifetime. I forgive you. You forgive me. Let's go through that. Make sure that's all taken care of. And I love you.
Big point that say everything you need to say.
Yeah. Clear the energetic channel. Cause if not, that's going to be a little bit of a weight that I think can get in the way. And, you know, just so you know, we do trainings on this because so many people want to know how to do this. You know, so I invite people, if they're interested, to look us up. We have,
ShareDeathCrossings.com.
ShareDeathCrossings.com.
ShareCrossings.com. All right. And I just want to say, anything anybody didn't get to say before anybody passed, you can still say it. And William, I know we both know they still hear it. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I hope everybody runs out and gets a copy of At Heaven's Door. You've done such a service for everybody with this book. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you looking for help on your path to healing? I'm Lisa Campion. I'm a psychic, Reiki master, teacher, and energy healer. On my podcast, The Miracle of Healing, I'm going to help you on your healing path. Listen to conversations with leading teachers in energy medicine, quantum healing, and people who have recovered from loss and illness. Whether it's to take care of your own healing or to help other people, this is the podcast for you. right here on mindbodyspirit.fm.